Star Trek 57, M23, take two.
Star Trek Podcast.
Computer!
Don't!
Or what?
You'll kill me?
If you call for the exit, you might kill Sisko and the others, and I am not prepared to risk that.
I'm afraid I don't believe you'll pull that trigger.
I wouldn't be so sure about that.
It's time to face reality, Doctor. You're a man who dreams of being a hero because you know, deep down, that you're not. I'm no hero either, but I do know how to make a choice. And I'm choosing to save myself.
Computer, show me the mechanism!
I ate the cheesers, and now I ate a couple gummy bears. Once I eat the gummy bears, I'm good. I'm good. Once these get chewed up, we're good to go.
Is that a fact?
It's brass tacks time.
I mean, we could go right now. You guys can go. I'm just finishing these gummy bears.
All right, let's.
I'm all about podcasting.
Start without Patrick.
I'm just eating some gummy bears.
So, welcome to the podcast. This is the Star Trek podcast. Our man Bashir is what we're watching. This is like, we're on some high up there episodes, and we're going to talk about it. And
what are you talking about? It was like four seasons, buddy.
Season four.
Well, I meant dab right in the fucking middle.
I meant our podcast, the personal cast.
Yeah, it was number 103.
Did you know that TNG and Voyager, everyone knows that TNG and Voyager had seven seasons, but do you know how many?
I thought you were going to say they had sex together.
Yeah, they had sex together.
They wished.
All seven seasons.
They wanted to.
But do you know how many seasons DS9 had?
Yeah, seven seasons.
Ah,
everybody knows that. Come on, that was like why it was so shocking when Enterprise was canceled after four seasons, because we're like, no, it was three seasons, and then it was seven seasons, and then seven seasons, and then seven seasons, and then four seasons. Come on, that doesn't even fit the pattern. Cancel it after three, or let it go to seven.
Yeah, it was three. Was the TOS?
Three was TOS. TOS was two seasons canceled, brought
two,
back.
And then like a third.
What
then
was
a third
and but then canceled TAS again. TAS was only like one season.
TAS was two seasons. The first season had 16 episodes. The second season had 8 episodes, I believe.
If it was He-Man.
Because animation, you can do whatever the fuck you want. You can just make shit up. You can be like, this is a season. This is a fucking season. Here you go. 16 episodes, that's a season. This other show, 50 episodes, that's a season.
It's actually not a lot because... In relative to Filmations, because they did the TAS, but they also did He-Man.
It was not a successful show.
He-Man would have
it's
like
50
or 60 episodes a season or something ridiculous.
But they were really
exactly.
short.
Yeah, it was like F Troop style.
Rather short, the He-Mans.
Yeah, except He-Man himself.
I think TAS is a little bit longer.
He-Man himself was not short, though. Skeletor looked pretty tall.
Skeletor.
Who was the little
guy? I was
guy.
More of a She-Ra guy myself. I found He-Man a bit derivative, if you know what I mean. But She-Ra had some original stuff going for
it. Well, yeah, it was different.
Oh, what are we talking about this week anyway?
Our man Bashir.
We welcome you to Deep Space Nine, a space station on the frontier. And thus we go densely to search for our man Bashir. Does that work?
Totally.
Extemporaneous rhyming prose?
It says the first full season of He-Man had 65 episodes, and so did the second season. But were you saying each episode was only like 15 minutes?
Yeah, they were like shorter, kind of.
Like I said, you can do whatever the fuck you want with animation.
Yeah.
You can just do whatever you want.
Yeah,
you don't have to follow the rules.
They probably did all those like 65 episodes like in a day or something.
Yeah, they probably did.
And then
did.
Like animated it later.
Well, I'll have to do some research into this because I'm... Something says 39 episodes, something says 65 episodes. It's very confusing.
most of that.
Now they got a whole brand new kind of He-Man out.
He-Man sucks.
He-Man does suck. She-Ra rules. He-Man sucks. Yeah. Gem and the Gemsters. What was it called? Gem and the
Diamond.
Gem and the Argonauts.
Gem and the Diamond Mephisto.
That show was
Diamond
weird,
Mephisto. Gem and the. It was not Gem and the Argonauts. You've aggravated me. It was called like Gem and the Gemtastics or something.
Gem and the lightning lasers.
So many people in our audience are banging their heads against their MP3 players, telephones, or televisions.
It was like Gem and the purple lines or something.
I know this. This is so embarrassing because I watched the fuck out of this show.
I watched a lot of Gem.
Gem was a good show. J-E-M, like J period.
Gem
E period.
And the hologram.
Yeah, the hologram. Why the fuck did I not remember that? Jesus Christ.
I was close.
Like a Star Trek.
And
I was...
Gem is spelled with a J.
Yeah.
Well, I knew that too. In my mind, that's why J-E-M, yeah. J period E period M period.
I was close when I said Gem and the purple lines. That was pretty close.
It is really close. It's astoundingly close.
Okay.
So yeah, Gem, she was a rock star that turned into a superhero.
And it make
and she used the power of rock.
And it's okay to talk about it because this is a show about holograms.
She had magical earrings.
Gem and the holograms, and this is a show, this episode of Deep Space Nine is about holograms.
She rocked, Gem rocked so hard that she had superhero powers with how hard she could rock.
And she changed the universe. You know how Bill and Ted changed the world?
Yeah.
Gem changed the fucking universe.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Yeah. It's an assertion without any evidence.
I'll buy it.
But I believe in it. I have the faith in that in that particular assertion.
So yeah, holograms. So, and this is a holodeck episode.
And this is a Star Trek podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
That remains to be seen.
Our man Bashir, partly we picked this because last week we discussed Voyager's season 5 episode Bride of Chaotica, and that is another episode like this one in which somebody is threatened. In the previous episode it was the entire crew. In this episode it's a subset of the crew members, wrapped up in the holodeck adventure, and it results in our hero characters having to follow along with some hilarious conceit. In the previous episode, it was Captain Proton / Flash Gordon style serials. And in this episode, what was it, Dan?
It was like James Bond.
Yes, it was James.
But it was also kind of like a Sherlock Holmes Watson kind of deal too, though, because
Garrick.
Yeah. But it was the idea of that you got Bashir, who's just trying to do the mission, and then Garrick is like sort of the anchor, the emotional anchor.
Good old garrulous Garrick.
They don't do a lot of holodeck episodes in Deep Space Nine. It's mostly a TNG Voyager kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I think they must have done that. They must have strayed away from that on purpose.
There's a little, yeah.
Because in TNG...
There's a lot in TNG.
Yeah, and there's in Deep Space Nine, there are many references to the holosuites, to Quark's holosuites.
It's usually where, like, you know, the people that...
You see him coming out of
it. Unsavory folks go there.
Well, there's the...
Yeah, it's
the
mainly for sex.
The sex part of it. Yeah. But
Or baseball.
The context we see it in usually is our characters either going into or coming out, more often coming out of the holosuites.
Dressed up. And
so we don't see the adventure they had. We see, which I think is great. It's brilliant writing because we see, for example, Kira, when Worf was introduced in Way of the Warrior, which we discussed a while back, Kira and Dax come out and they're dressed as like princesses.
Yeah,
they're
right.
Having some argument. And so we get to imagine this nebulous adventure that they had without seeing it. And then that's what we normally are dealing with.
I saw one that was like, it was Bashir and O'Brien, and they were coming out of like some kind of Battle of Britain.
Yeah.
And O'Brien was doing like a British accent.
So I liked this episode a lot more. I enjoyed it a lot more than the Voyager episode. The Voyager episode was good, but this actually gave you like there was more about characterization, more character stuff going on in the Deep Space Nine episode. The Voyager stuff was just kind of stuff happening and it was fun and neat, but there was really, it didn't give you any insight in anything.
Bashir's a more interesting guy and he's got better holodeck program than Tom Paris.
And I like the implication that and this is one of the first times we see this, is where they introduce this implication that you have these people who are pretty good at the holodeck programming, and they pass them around, right? So Bashir has gotten this program passed to him, recommended by some friend. And this was, I forget exactly the year this aired. This was season four. So,
oh, 95.
Yeah, 95, 96, something like that. 95.
November 27th, 1995. So,
what, you know, just to set the scene for some of our younger listeners who weren't around.
You were talking about high school.
Perhaps born in 1995.
No.
I was thinking that passed around like high school. TI-82 calculator games.
See, that's honestly even nerdier than what I was going to say, because I was talking about BBSs.
Okay.
I was going to talk about the sort of pre-internet BBSs where we, you know, Dan and I each ran it. We had our own BBSs back in the day, and people would call up on a modem. There was no internet. You
modems.
called up using a modem person at a time
if you
and
wanted
transfer
to use,
files and games.
If
and
you
things.
Wanted to use internet, you had to use like AOL or Prodigy, and you'd pay by the minute or something.
Yeah. Or you could use Errol's internet or some other local provider. But the point being is that the internet was just
Juno.
Now was emerging, so a lot of people are using these BBSs. And but you this episode is filmed in that era when a cool computer program would be passed around by word of mouth on disk or via primitive you know, advanced at the time, bulletin board systems where you could go post a file, upload a file, make it available for other people to use, that sort of thing.
Yeah, they didn't really have much of a concept of internet in Star Trek in general. I mean, as
no, it's hilarious. It's one of the things that Star Trek invented all these things like fucking flip phones and hospital bed monitors and things like that, but they didn't really invent the internet.
Yeah, I mean, one example is kind of sort of a side example of course, the pads, how you need a different pad for different things.
Like a thousand pads.
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
You don't need a thousand different pads.
And then we were talking about in Enterprise once Hoshi was talking about, it's like, I'm here to deliver, give me your message so I can send it out, like over the airways. But they did that in this episode too, in DS9, when they were coming back from the thing. There was some, I can't remember the
exact.
There
was some backlog of messages for Sisko to listen to.
It's like, why didn't it just come to his phone or something? Like, why is it, like, yeah, why is
I
it?
Think one of the best examples we see of that, actually, of that.
Maybe it's harder to do internet in space.
Well, it's not about that. It's about they didn't have the conception of the internet yet. Because the internet, the internet started way before we know ARPANET and all that other jazz. But in terms of the public using the internet in a meaningful way, and certainly the World Wide Web, you're talking the mid-90s when that stuff is first being developed, you know, 93, 94, 95. But in terms of the public, it's not quite there yet. An example that we discussed past tense. Remember when we did a podcast episode on past tense parts 1 and 2 from Deep Space Nine, where they travel back to 2024. And one of the hilarious things is they get so much right, scarily right about, you know, the future, that, you know, that period of Earth, because, you know, they're like putting all the homeless people into special friendly zones for homeless people, that sort of thing. But they don't have internet. And everyone has these giant consoles that are like built into desks.
Yeah.
They haven't figured out the portable smartphone form factor.
And they kind of made a side reference to that in the Voyager episode, because Paris was like, yeah, I'm doing back studying how people in the past thought the future was going to be like or something. I don't know if they did that on purpose, but, you know, that's kind of like
what they did. Yeah. And the Bride of Chaotica is a classic episode. It's a great episode. It is a really fun episode. It's enjoyable to watch. But I'm on board with you, Dan, in terms of this episode for me is better. It's a little.
I said that too.
And Jesse also said that.
And even down to you know, I like them.
It's a better holodeck program.
I said that. I like when we start to see the strengths of Rom as well, sort of, and that came through, and how he has his own system of engineering, and everyone and Eddington's like, what the fuck is this shit? But you can tell.
And speaking of Eddington, this is before all the shit went down with editing.
Oh,
Eddington.
Right. And he joined up with the Maquis.
Yeah, well, he was like already with the Maquis at this stage, but we just didn't know that yet.
So, and then
if you can get like, what's his name? Quark to like get off of Rom's back, then Rom comes through.
Yes.
Like,
you know. Yeah. And it was cool how he, and because Quark wouldn't give Rom the shit he needed, he
Quark!
Had to,
Quark!
Quark! Right. He had to be, creative. And so he used a spatula. He's like, it's the same materials as blah, blah, blah.
I think you can see like a colander in there. Or something. Yeah. You see, there's a couple other things.
It looks like a junkyard.
Yeah.
But as I imagine, as an engineer, you got it. If someone has those materials available to them and they're able to pull this off, that's pretty respectable. You know, it's like, like Rom can do some shit, and Rom's
badass.
And he's, and there was a part where like they were,
no.
when he was, Eddington was worried about the setup or something. And Rom Tom was just like, well, it's the best I can do. And he like, there was no insecurity there. It was just like, it's almost like Rom saying, I know my shit. I can't do this. I'm secure enough with my ability that it's the best I can do. I'm not going to make any excuses. Yeah. I'm not going to be like, sorry. It's like, this is, if you can do any better, fucking go and try.
Rom is,
you know,
so nice, and that's about as close as you'll get to having Rom just say, be like, fuck you, man.
Yeah. It's the best I can do.
Look at this shit.
Yeah, right.
Well, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah, exactly.
These are private holosuites. These are not Federation caliber holodecks on a galaxy class starship. It's not even on an Intrepid class starship. These are privately owned holosuites that Quark relies on for business, yet also will not invest in upgrading and appropriate repair materials, etc.
Right, and so he was talking about how it was, they had to spend an extra hour fixing the holosuite because he's like, they weren't made to interface with Starfleet, which that makes sense. But somehow
it's a Cardassian station.
Were they Cardassian holodecks? I don't think so.
Well, I mean, they're private holodecks installed into a Cardassian station. Quark probably bought them from whatever the equivalent to...
It's a Cardassian computer.
Sony or Yamaha or whatever.
Point aside...
RCA.
They were worried about them interfacing.
Samsung, LG.
Yes, I can tell your story.
They're still using the RCA plug.
You've always got to keep some RCA plugs around. You don't know. You get these new TVs these days, and all you get is you get your HDMIs, and occasionally you get a display point. You don't get enough RGB connectors. I'm fine without the coax. Okay, we got to let that go.
All that aside, my point.
That is the interface of the holosuite into the Cardassian station. Now they've got to interface it with Federation technology.
Yeah, and so that makes...
To save the lives of the crew.
Yes.
we didn't explicitly state that.
Okay,
most of the main characters.
But we know this from watching the fucking episode.
I know, and we know the audience has watched the episode before, but there are... Okay, here's the deal. It's a quick aside.
Jesus,
we've got
No,
the good audience, and I'm not trying to make a hierarchy of audience here, but I will say the good people, they've done their homework, they've watched the episode, they've refreshed their memory, so everything is clear. However, we do have those smarty pants out there, and I know you're out there because I'm sometimes one of you, where I'm thinking, I've seen this episode a million times. I know there's some of those people out there, so I don't want them to be embarrassed. And so if we occasionally provide additional context of where we are in the episode, then we avoid embarrassing our overconfident listeners.
I mean, if you want to sell out, that's fine. You know?
Yes, I mean, yeah, okay, you know, fair point. Fair point.
No, that's very considerate of you, Patrick. All jokes aside,
I don't like boxing people into embarrassing corners because some people, you know, they don't necessarily respond so well to that.
Yeah, and sometimes people are looking for a reason to tear someone else down unnecessarily. It's like, oh, you didn't know that one thing. You must not really be a fan. You didn't know that one thing. You didn't know that one thing. You suck. You suck.
It's honestly.
Oh, it doesn't matter because you didn't know that one thing.
I do. Is somewhat hilarious. Okay, so to pull the curtain back, if once you are on a podcast that has a certain level of popularity, you'll start getting trolls coming after you. But it's quite hilarious when, you know, they post ridiculous statements and they often get a factual error in the statement. Now, I don't have a problem with people having factual errors. How the fuck are you going to know every single thing about Star Trek at all? I mean, we've been watching since we were kids, and that's a very long time ago.
No one can know everything.
But you know, you got to refresh your memories and stuff like that. But it's so funny when somebody critiques you, and in the critique gets some very basic fact wrong because they didn't watch an episode of Enterprise or they didn't watch an episode of TAS or something, and they think they're hardcore lore masters, but they're not.
Yeah, and then especially when they word it all snarky, it's like, next time you try to talk about a subject, make sure you know what the fuck you're talking about.
I know.
Make sure the foggy booba doo and the boobo, not the boobo baba boo. Duh.
It's like, come on.
Nice try.
Meanwhile,
I guess anyone can get up there and suck and not know shit.
Meanwhile, they're the ones that not only spend an hour and a half listening to some terrible bullshit, but then took time out of their day to compose and no doubt recompose and edit comments on the internet. But we do welcome comments, positive and negative. But the negative comments, I respect negative comments when they're factually accurate, which does happen.
And you don't have to be a dick about it.
You like, don't have to be. Nobody has to be a dick.
You don't have to like try to use this as an opportunity to get ahead in the F1 racing track of life.
I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example of somebody. It was nice, but this is not, I'm not denigrating this person, but you know, we posted some dossiers, right? Some dossiers, however you prefer to pronounce it. Of the characters, the various characters involved in this story are our man Bashir, which I do promise we are going to be talking about. Mm-hmm. And
I've been trying to make this point for the past 15 minutes.
Exactly. And Dan's about to he's getting there. And but what happened was, you know, I posted these all over the social medias, you know, these were meant to be humorous. You know, it's up to you whether or not they were humorous or not. But one of the humorous elements was that I, for Julian Bashir, I listed his name as Julian, quotation marks, Jules Bashir. But Jules was spelled as in the, you know, like emeralds and diamonds, Jules.
Jules.
As opposed to Jules.
Where the diamonds?
Short for Julian.
What's this from? Where the diamonds?
I don't know.
A Fish Called Wanda.
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, that's a great movie. Oh. We got a comment on Facebook where somebody said, I don't believe it's spelled Jules. I believe it's spelled J-U-L-E-S, which is short for Julian. And then somebody else responded saying like, yeah, I think it was meant to be a joke. And then I responded, yes, it was meant to be a joke. And then that first person responded from, like, they linked to Memory Alpha with Julian's, you know, Jules Bashir. And I was like, I don't understand how this is not clear that this was a joke. It's in quotation marks and it's a homophone.
And
you know?
You were goofing on everybody else's.
I was goofing on
too.
Everybody else. Yeah. I mean, I said that the character Honey Bear was good. Her favorite hobby was She's All That.
Yeah.
Which is because she took her glasses off, which apparently were non-prescription glasses, and then she let down her hair and quote-unquote became beautiful.
Yeah, Garrick actually groaned at that part, which was funny. It was kind of like, oh, I'm groaning, he's going after her, but it's like, this is such a fucking
And I think this came out before She's All That, because She's All That was like 97, 99,
I like,
something like that.
I like when someone points out to you that what you took seriously was actually a joke, and so your response is to provide evidence that what you're saying is true. It's like, yes, I know what you're saying is true, but that's not the point. I was making a joke.
And that was all, of course, very innocent and stuff. It's more fun. It's funny because sometimes...
It's fun. We love you.
I'm reminded sometimes, okay, we spend so much time goofing around and having fun that I'm
so
reminded...
So much fun.
I'm, yes,
we're weird.
A great deal of fun.
Why are we so weird?
A great deal of weirdness.
We're so weird.
There's a certain degree of
people
weirdness
don't always understand me because I'm so weird. But that's also what they say they like about me.
Occasionally,
I'm so weird.
Limitations to the comprehension people might have of us because of our degree of weirdness.
Ah!
And you know, occasionally we just shout out a bunch of nonsense and gibberish. These are all facts, sure. You know, it's a subjective thing. This whole
those facts are so random.
Okay. Our man Bashir has got a hologram. It's got holograms.
It's got holograms. It's got some holograms.
He's got like a bunch of holograms. It's good though. It's good though.
Yeah, it's good.
It's a good episode. It's good to watch.
Holograms are good.
Yeah. Holodeck's fun.
Yeah. So
I was always sad they didn't go back to this. Although I was also the other part of me is like, you know what? If they did really go back to this, they would have fucked it up in some way because that's usually what happens. They reference this. This is the Our Man Bashir adventures are referenced. But you know, the episode ends with the whole like, well, I'm sure Dr. Bashir will be back. Damn it.
He just dropped something.
Yeah.
His phone fell on the floor.
Yeah, he's got a floor phone. Florfin. He's been florfin. Is your phone florfed?
My phone is all florfed. We're led to believe we're going to see more adventures of Dr. Bashir on the holodeck, and I'm sure that was their plan. But they ended up doing all the Vic Fontaine stuff. I think they stumbled into that. Mm. And that worked out very well. So nobody's complaining, but... They do reference this whole storyline, this whole the obsession Dr. Bashir has with this playing spy thing.
Right. So originally, what the point I was making about how...
It was about 15 minutes ago. Right?
Yeah, about Rom saying that they need to, he needs time to fit the interface to DS9.
To Starfleet stuff.
Okay, that makes
actually,
sense.
Actually, it was the Defiant, right?
Yeah.
Well, they used the Defiant, but it was just Starfleet stuff in general. They used the Defiant because it was convenient.
Starfleet stuff?
So, okay. So So that makes sense. What doesn't make sense is how the images inserted, the images of the people who got telezapped, how the images inserted themselves into the program is dubious.
Of course.
The Holosuite could just adapt this human data protocol into its holodeck protocol.
It wanted to make some physical people, okay?
So,
and then their neurological stuff is in the rest of the memory banks of the station.
But
so people are dying of oxygen, lack of oxygen.
But the problem is their rules are conflicting, because on the one hand, Rom is saying, I need time to modify this to fit your shit. That's one rule they've established. The other rule they've established is that the human data human.
Are you talking about like plebes and prawls?
No. I'm talking about the human data protocol can magically fit itself into the holo protocol. You see what I'm saying? It's like you got these human data information, and somehow it magically gets converted. You need some kind of API to convert the human data from the teleporter.
Future computers can build those. They're duotronic.
What are they called?
They're duotronic computers.
Diatronic?
They're duotronic.
It's spelled diatronic.
I didn't look it up from last week, this whole argument we had, but I guarantee you it's not diatronic.
I guarantee you $1 million.
Right, we could solve this by looking it up, but neither of us will.
Nope, we won't. So,
look, on the fly APIs.
What do they call it?
In the future, we will have on the fly APIs. Ask the computer to do some shit, the computer will be like, "Man, we'll develop an API."
So why couldn't it API it for the Holosuite to Starfleet stuff? Why did they have to make a special?
That's a good point.
That's my point. That's my point. Is there
fair fucking point?
Look, you make up whatever rules you want. Let Cisco cast fireballs if he wants, but you have to stay consistent within the rules you've set. And one rule.
Didn't know what an API was in 1995.
No, but one rule said...
I think that's the answer.
One rule said...
They were all about the C++ object-oriented programming.
One rule said...
This is officially a chant now, Dan.
No, I'm trying to make my point.
It's a chant.
But you guys keep not listening and interrupting instead.
I'm totally listening.
You're spending 100%. All the listening time thinking of ways to interrupt.
No. They're not thinking of ways. They're coming to us.
Rom has to specifically modify his equipment to fit Starfleet's equipment, but the human data doesn't need to. Nobody has to specifically modify the human data to fit in the Holosuite.
You made me think of a human version of Data.
So if you need to, if one can automatically transform itself, why can't the other? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I agree 100%. Because they didn't conceptualize APIs. They were all about the object-oriented programming back in the day. I mean, I said C++. As far as we know, these motherfuckers were schooled in Turbo Pascal.
But then why did they have to...
That's probably true.
But then why did they have to... If they didn't conceptualize the idea of modifying data, why did they have to do that for the Holosuite? And is that because it was hardware?
I'm not defending their position. I'm suggesting a potential reason for the inconsistency in the application of the rules that you have defined, that you have identified, I should say.
They just don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, they don't know what they're talking
about. Maybe it's because the Holosuite does a hardware interaction with the
Starfleet.
Maybe
it's because these motherfuckers were writing scripts on non-networked PC computers in like a computer lab on the Paramount lot.
Maybe the Holosuite was a hardware wiring to the Starfleet, whereas... The data from the humans to the holodecks was a software thing. Maybe that's what it was.
Humans to holodecks.
From humans to holodecks.
From humans to holodecks sounds like a great, like a philosophical book.
Transporter buffer information to Holosuite information.
See, it works for me in the context of Star Trek because it's like, sure, why not? You know, they shunted a thing. They went through the isolinear core and flip-flopped onto B-blops, and it's like the computer was like, I can put this shit here and I can put that shit there. And the reason why, of course, it's a suspension.
Then why can't they do that interface the Holosuite with the Starfleet equipment?
We won't belabor the point that it requires a suspension of disbelief. Okay. But it requires a relatively standard Star Trek-style suspension of disbelief in that the plot required... That we have actors act as goofy versions of themselves, so they had to separate the neural from the physical,
right?
With the physical, and it's clever in that sense. So, I respect it for being clever in that sense.
And I'll say that the way they handle it after that is mostly all right. Like, it's true, you don't want to shut this thing down because you don't know what's going to happen. Like, you've got this unstable data that The whole program could crash.
Now you're making me think of like an unstable data, like in lore, or like in like a Fistful of Datas.
So they So when they're talking about like, we don't want to shut this program down, we don't know what's going to happen. That makes sense because you don't know. This whole program could crash at any second. You know, they don't know that this fucked up weird program that's using weird transporter buffer data in its holosuite, we don't know that's not going to crash at any moment. So that made sense. It's like, we don't want to fuck with this. Yeah. But what didn't make sense...
They'd have to make new bodies for all those characters because they'd still have all their mind data, but they wouldn't have their body data.
So could they make a new body in the holodeck and then use the transporter to transport those holodeck bodies?
No. The replicator. Replicator.
Yeah, holodeck ain't going to be making a fresh body. I mean, yeah.
Replicator.
Otherwise, you know...
What also
3D
did,
printing?
No, 3D printing. That's the way.
3D printing.
That's basically what the Prodigy has, right? Or the Prodigy, the Soul Star.
Yeah, I mean, and retroactively, Prodigy introduced the idea of a replicating shuttles, which would actually make Voyager make a lot more sense because they seem to go through a lot of shuttles.
Yeah, they do. Okay, so it. That was pretty good. The only problem then I had was that the idea that if you get killed in the holodeck, you get killed in real life. I'm not talking about the safety protocols being off. I'm talking about if transporter buffer Kira O'Brien, they were going to kill O'Brien.
If your pattern's in there, that's where your pattern's being
but
saved.
But they were saying when you get killed, you get deleted. No, you don't. Why would you get deleted if you get killed?
That's a good point because your corpse would just be there. Yeah. Do you think it would simulate your corpse rotting? Like, if a holodeck character is shot dead, would it simulate the rotting and the putrefaction of their corpse?
Because it depends on how you wrote it.
If the character dies in the story of the character's data isn't erased, they're still in the program.
Right. What if the person wanted to say, computer, go back 5 minutes?
Right.
Or reset program. Like, it's not going to erase. Maybe they have some special technique where they momentarily erase it and bring it back, but that's stupid. They don't say anything.
Agree. That's ludicrous.
Yeah. So,
but again, 1995.
Maybe that's how Bashir made his program.
People were thinking crazy things in 1995.
I mean, it all served the purpose of giving the episode steaks. That's basically all it was for. And snakes? That's fine. Some delicious steaks.
Oh, steaks.
Snakes. Snakes on a steak.
Snakes. Have you had snake steak? No. Snake steak's pretty good.
Sounds like something I want to eat.
Yeah, it's just diced. They just cut up snakes and cook them up. It's not really like a steak.
Is it like an eel?
It's like a better tasting
did you
eel.
Eat
like
the sh- eel. Did you eat the shit out of it?
I don't. I
they
think
clean
they,
the
I
shit
they,
out before they.
I think
feed
they gut it.
It.
They gut it and clean it.
Some people won't eat the shrimp when it's got the poop vein in it.
Yeah, it's fine. I don't care.
The poop vein's
I don't care about shrimp.
I'm not that picky.
Shrimp poop is not something that concerns me.
Some people like the crab mustard.
It's
that's
so
a little
alien.
More intense.
That's a little weirder.
Not
yeah.
into the crab
it's
mustard.
Not the worst.
Yeah, that tastes weird.
I don't have a problem with anybody who is into the crab mustard or into anything.
Or there's like lobster.
Be into whatever you
there's
want.
There's lobster
be free.
Mustard too.
Lobster mustard.
I just like that lobster meat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what you really want. You don't need to. If you want to eat the gut, the goo, and the brains or whatever.
So the way that Garrick got put into this episode was it was a little like forced. He just decided to
crash in the holodeck program.
They just wanted to see Garrick in a tuxedo.
Holodeck program.
Well, I like that Garrick was in the episode. I think he added. Without him, it wouldn't be the
Garrick was
the
jealous.
Same
he was fucking lonely.
What do you think he was lonely?
He said he was fucking lonely.
He's always lonely.
He
that guy.
Pointed out. He said Julian. Jules. Jules, Dr. Jules Julian Bashir. Julian Jules Bashir. He said, ever since you've got this fucking program, you have not been coming to have lunch with me. And Garrick is trying to tell Julian, he's like, you got to fucking understand how important it is.
What are those people eating?
You and I have fucking goddamn lunch.
Yeah.
They're eating Hasperat and drinking Ractogenas.
What is Hasperat?
It's some sort of Bajoran stew.
Oh, it's
some
a stew.
Sort.
So is that an example of them just being really good pals?
That is an example of them having a mildly homoerotic relationship.
See, that's what I was thinking now that, because I never thought about
they
that.
They were stifled
it's like
by
a, like a talking sort of eroticism.
Right.
By Rick Berman and the jackals at Paramount or
the jackals.
Syndicators.
Right. So I never put that together before until I think one of you guys mentioned it. And I was like, oh yeah, now I'm watching it differently. Like thinking about that.
There's
now.
Definitely, there's
two
a,
fancy
and
guys.
There is a homoerotic, potentially homosexual, and definitely homosocial. Homosociality is those non-sexual, non-erotic relationships between men, often that are the types of relationships that help gird the male patriarchy. right? There's a homeless social relationships, like the rituals and the attitudes,
like,
the like you know you're hanging out and you give the guy the job, you know, because right. you know him, or you know him from the Moose Lodge or whatever,
right? Moose
that's
Lodge.
That sort of shit.
The Fuselage. Like,
you make an make agreement,
you know, from the Muselics.
You're like, we make an agreement that we're not going to sleep with each other's wives. You know, that's like some sort of homosocial arrangement that maintains the patriarchy.
So you don't think there was anything deeper than it was just kind of a plot device to get Garrick to come in there?
I think it was deeper in the sense that it was they were really demonstrating that Garrick was
it was lonely
at the very basic level. If you don't want to read too much into it, you don't have to, but it is very clear that it is Garrick is missing his friend.
Yeah.
Now later in the episode we see Bashir call Garrick out for another thing that may in fact be true. If Garrick got wind that this was a spy program,
he wanted to check it out.
And then he might have wanted to make kind of mock Bashir a little bit, kind of, you know. But the main thrust of it is that Garrick misses his friend and wants to hang out with him and cherishes his time and his conversations at lunch when they're debating Cardassian versus versus Earth literature, etc.
So Garrick's whole tactic to get in there is your classic cop question line of questioning, where he goes, you know, why are you so protective? Are you afraid I'll find some humiliating secrets about you? And he's like, no, it's just a fantasy, Garrick. You know, I'm not hiding anything, Garrick, dude. And Garrick,
Bashir was totally gonna fuck that hologram girl.
Yeah, and maybe they was jealous. But then Garrick,
Mona loves it.
Then
Mona loves it. No, was Mona loves it his valet?
Then
I think he was gonna have sex with her as well.
Yeah, and then, but the blonde woman in the beginning.
Yes, I can't remember her name.
Then Garrick,
she wasn't named.
Then maybe. Garrick says, "Well, if you've got nothing to hide, then why not let me stay?" That classic question.
And it worked.
And that's bullshit, because we all
worked,
know.
Even though Bashir is a genetically engineered genius, he still fell for that because he's got a genetically engineered ego as well.
Yeah, it's like your bank account password. It's like, it's not that you're ashamed of it, and not telling people about it doesn't mean that you're doing something nefarious. In fact, it's bad to tell someone about something like that. So just because you're hiding, just because you don't want to tell someone, doesn't mean you're hiding some secret shame.
That's not something you're supposed to share.
It's just like some things you don't supposed to share. Yeah, and Bashir fell for it. Yeah, why did Bashir, the fucking human being who's super dude?
There's two ways you can read it.
Garrick sweet talked.
One way you can read it is, it doesn't really matter.
Maybe Bashir really liked it.
It was necessary for the plot.
Maybe Bashir was playing hard to get at first.
The other way you could read it, that's a potential third way to read it. But the other way you could read it is that, it's similar to what you're saying. It's related to that relationship where Bashir is genetically engineered. We know that. We don't know that yet, by the way, at this stage in the
Do you think the writers know that yet?
The writers don't know that yet. They came up with that last minute, and
those guys are bozos.
Alexander Siddig was not a fan of that particular plot line. But the fact is that you take away the genetic engineering. Bashir, by any accounts, is he's an intelligent, clever fellow, but he does have an ego and he has insecurities, and some of those insecurities are associated with the fact that, yes, he's a very good doctor, but the whole reason he selected the Deep Space Nine post in the first place is he wanted the frontier, you know, he wanted to be all like out there. So
he's not super tall either, is he?
He's trying to prove something to himself in some way, right? And you could say this is a version of some sort of, I don't know, whatever forms of masculinity still unfortunately exist in the future. It could be, that's what it seems like. That's the thing that's somewhat incongruous about it is this is supposed to be taking place in the 24th century, but Bashir is reacting in very, very masculine, toxic masculinity ways, in the sense that he's like, I want to go do spy shit and prove that I have skills,
and
by doing these holographic stories.
And if you've gotten really nothing to hide and someone tries to play that line on you, if you got nothing to hide, if you really have nothing to hide, I imagine you just go like, no, I don't have anything to hide. I just don't want you in here. You'd be confident in your knowledge that you're not hiding anything. You would have nothing to prove to them. I don't need to prove to you that I'm not hiding something, because I don't give a fuck. But if you've got something to hide, embarrassing, you want to go, you know, over the
some
top.
People, some people just,
a little
you know, so you're a little embarrassed about it. So that's why you're more likely to say, oh, well, I got nothing to hide. Come check it out, because you're covering up and you're going a little too hard on
the great. The great irony of it is that Bashir proves that he was embarrassed by the program by acceding to Garrick's demand. Right. Because one would expect in the 24th century, nobody gives a shit about what you do or who you're fucking or you know, all that other stuff. It should really be meaningless, right? If he had just told Garrick, he's like, no, I'm not, like you said, I'm not fucking embarrassed, but I like single player games, buddy.
Yeah, dog.
I'm playing right now. I'm playing a single player game. This is not GTA San Andreas Online. This is a single player game. This is not Elder Scrolls Online. This is Skyrim.
Right.
Get what I'm saying?
It's not Bajor. You can't just like show up here and Cardassian.
But that's right. Yeah, that's so the thing is, the brilliance, the consistent brilliance of Deep Space Nine is that even though they're doing crazy sci-fi stories and sometimes patently absurd stories, and this kind of is that, the characters still all fit the characterization. Julian Bashir is a highly intelligent, highly skilled, but nevertheless insecure person. And his character arc, a lot of that involves him overcoming some of those insecurities and at the same time realizing that the things he decides to volunteer for are going to change him in ways that he didn't expect, right? And Garrick is acting like, not only like Garrick the individual, but you know, the sort of Cardassian stereotypical, they, you know, I'll do what I fucking want. I'm just going to show up where I want to be and do what I want to do. And in this case, I'm going to hack into your private program. Cause that's the implication. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes is missed because it's not stated explicitly.
Well, he says it's illegal when Bashir says it's
Bashir illegal. Says it's illegal, but really the implication is Garrick got in here because he has the skills to do that. He was able to break into the program.
Yeah. And in fact, Garrick was fucking with him, because, like after they were arguing and Garrick was trying to, you know, be, you know, a thorn on Bashir's side or whatever. And then he's like, but if I may make one observation, and Bashir's like, Garrick, you fucker, shut up. And Garrick's like, I only want to point out that your lovely companion is leaving. That was trickery. He presented like he's giving some unwanted advice because he wants Bashir to be like, fuck off, Garrick. But really, he knew Bashir would want to know that advice, but he presented it as if it was unwanted advice. And so it was pure psychiatric manipulation. You know, if I go up to you and I say, hey, Jesse, and you're like, get fuck off, Dan. And I was like, Jesse, guess what? And you're like, fuck off, Dan. I'm like, your hair's on fire. And you're like, oh, no. You know, you would say to me.
That's like what I say to you. And you're like, fuck off.
Yeah, but my hair's not actually on fire. In this case, your hair would be on fire. And after I said that to you, you would say to me, you'd be like, why didn't you tell me that as if you were serious? You know?
This still sounds like the roles are reversed here.
Well, you know, I want to come out the hero in this situation. So, Bashir, at one point, goes, all right, now I have to be at work in 2 hours. I'd like to enjoy myself. So keep quiet and don't rain on my parade. And Garrick responds with, parade? That same thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Parade.
He didn't. Like he wasn't familiar with the expression.
He didn't understand the idiom.
Yeah. He didn't understand the idiom.
He didn't fucking understand. The idiom.
They don't have parades in Cardassia.
It is funny. It's such a dumb. It's such a repeated joke in Star Trek of an alien creature. Or species or race. I don't know. Whatever the appropriate term is. An alien sentient person not understanding the idiom.
Yeah.
And you could be Data, who's not strictly speaking alien.
Why would I punch the road? You know, or like,
is that a saying?
Right.
You know,
hit the road.
Oh, hit the road.
Why would I strike the ground with my fist? Why would I do that?
Why would it be raining cats and dogs?
That makes no sense. Oh,
are they horribly injured from the fall?
Yeah.
Due to their terminal velocity it would be chaos.
Yeah, that's why you want bugs. They don't have a problem with that.
It's raining bugs and dogs?
This has nothing to do with not understanding the idiom, but in the episode of the Proton, the Chaotica, Bride of Chaotica, when
Captain Proton.
When the doctor is talking to that alien, he's like, I'm the president of Earth, and the aliens are like, Earth. And then he's like something Captain Proton. He's like, Captain Proton. And that happened in that episode. Yeah. But that's different. It's the same, except different.
It's a cousin. It's a cousin to the not understanding the idiom. Mm-hmm. That's just not recognizing names and terms.
Yeah. So, yeah, how about that? Mona loves it.
Mona loves it. Yeah, with her boobies.
Yeah.
Boobies are laying out.
But she better get paid for all of her credentials, like biology, chemistry, and physics.
Oh my God. So,
and she's a valet.
You don't get paid if you did.
This is that, you know, period of the 90s where, first of all, you have Rick Berman, who by all accounts was a misogynistic, creepy motherfucker. So he was all about the sex. Nothing wrong with sex, but it is a problem when it's purely male gaze sex, and when it's always about, you know, positioning the women in subordinate positions to powerful men, right? That's boring and ridiculous, and we've had enough of
and,
that.
And actually, there's a scene later in this that I'm actually obsessed with this scene, but I'm fully aware that it's a male gaze scene. It's when Julian is in that... about to play cards with Worf.
Yes, so that, Baccarat.
The Baccarat, and there's this scene, it begins with the go-go dancers.
There's that one fella who's just staring, isn't it? That one guy who's just looking at the dancer.
Oh, I don't know, I didn't notice that.
He's an extra. There's one guy just staring up, and he's just smiling, and the girl is dancing.
Yeah, so...
The music is the worst for that scene.
I love it.
And this episode was emanated. This was nominated for an Emmy for Best Music, which I think it deserves the nomination, but not for that scene.
It was... Well, there was a... They did the like the My Sharona bass line at one point. It's like,
it's like, this doesn't sound like the 60s.
It was 1964.
It was like some jazzy surf rock.
It was like a total,
but like,
caricature.
I know that the whole scene was a caricature, and for that reason I'm completely obsessed with it, because it's something really fascinating that all the notes they hit in that scene, there's such a caricature, and it's so weird, and it's just, I'm like, what am I even looking at?
Because it's
the 90s.
It's filtered through so many layers. Because what I was going to say is that Rick Berman is a creepy dude. He's always pushing the sex stuff, and the fact is that you can do sex stuff, and that's fine. It's good, because sex is awesome, right? We're very sex positive,
and you know,
right?
The go-go dancer at the beginning when... Like, it's at the beginning, you know, she's dancing and it's very sexual and sexy or whatever, but I think it's pretty much okay. But then it's kind of like hangs on the ass for a while. Yeah. And that's when I was like, we didn't need that part.
That's the problematic direction. Now, here's the thing though. This is in the context.
I just called it the ass as if it's on a thing.
The ass.
So I didn't mean to objectify that the woman. I accidentally
ace,
did. Sorry.
You like a nice ace.
Bottom.
You know, like a nice
it
ace.
It focused on her butt when it didn't need to.
That is problematic. However, the thing that this episode has going for it is that it's being played through the lens of not only the hologram program, but a 1964 period accurate, not period accurate to actual spies, period accurate to the cultural depiction of spies, which included a lot of misogyny, included a lot of male gaze. So in some ways, that's a quote unquote excuse for this, right? They could have done a little bit better in terms of playing against the type, which they didn't. They did a little bit with Major Kira's Anastasia. What was her name? Anastasia Rachmaninoff or something?
Why was she calling herself Colonel?
Come on.
Colonel.
On,
she's a colonel.
I know, but she kept saying Colonel. Do Russians pronounce it colonel?
No, but Americans think Russians pronounce it that way.
In the 90s was another era where there was a lot of Russian impressions.
I'm a Russian.
There was a lot of impressions of Russians where it's like, I'm watching it, I'm like, I don't know that Russians sound like that.
Yeah, but then there was Yakov Smirnov, right. You know?
Well, it's like, did you ever see, it was the movie, the Matt Damon card movie called like Rounders or whatever. It had John Malkovich
which
playing.
Which is a terrible Russian accent.
Terrible, right? Like, his name was Mr.
Be that man, his man.
Yeah, right. So I can't. I don't know.
In Russia, Trek star you.
Yeah, I can't say for certain, but I imagine Nana Visitor's Russian accent was probably not great.
But again, it's played, and we talked about this last week with Bride of Chaotica, where it is tricky to play you're an actor in real life playing a character,
right,
playing another character. Yeah. It's a little different here because they're in the holodeck, right? But it's still the Major Kira's version, fundamentally, of Anastasia Nabokov.
When she went like, who's Dax? At the end of a scene,
who's Dax?
She had her hands on her hips and like put them out. That was, she does, she's done that in like her normal Kira thing.
That was,
maybe that's just the affectation of Nana Visitor, but like she's just kind of like frustrated, like, ah.
Better hairdo as this Russian spy than as Kira. Hey,
you don't like Kira's haircut?
Most of the Star Trek hair is kind of weird looking.
Yeah. That is
for everybody.
Because they go for future hair.
It's the future hair. I'm not into it.
I like Riker's. Riker's haircut.
Riker's got good hair. But in the new Star Trek shows, their hair is much better.
I agree.
It's a contemporary.
I agree. I think the new Star Trek does pretty good with the hair.
It's got hair.
It's got a fucking pillow full of hair.
I have it.
Just a pillow stuffed full of
human. A drain full of hair.
It's got a pillow stuff full of human
I have that song from that scene in my head. It's just like, it's terrible, but it's also like I can't stop thinking about it. It's something about it is really, it's like a shitty cheap
it's
drug.
It's like they scored it out, like the guy that wrote the music,
Jay Chataway,
the episode, like, was like, I'm gonna score out some like 60s sort of surf nonsense.
Yeah.
But like, I don't really care about how it sounds. It's just gonna be like a chord progression.
And I keep thinking about it, the other musical stings are really good.
Basic sort of surfy chord.
That scene is stands out in the music of that scene stands out in particular because, unlike the rest of the episode, it doesn't really match up very well. Whereas the rest of the episode, the variations on the Deep Space Nine stings,
with like James Bond version of the 60s Deep Nine stings,
that's great.
Yeah,
that's cool.
You know, like that was great. It was really, really well done. Really well done.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a lot, the decor, that the set design. Sucks. However, it is, of course, all through the filter of a Star Trek production with the limitations. They were decently budgeted, but these were sci-fi programs, and they were always going to be limited. And there's this weird thing that goes on in sci-fi programs where, especially in these earlier eras, where the budgets were limited, but it was almost a problem when they went to sets that were not sci-fi sets, because the sci-fi sets, you know, the Cardassian station, the planet made with cardboard rocks and that stuff, it fits into the sort of the melange of styles, sci-fi styles that are easy to suspend your disbelief for. But now when they're doing a set which is, this is an opulent club in Hong Kong or in some fancy city in the south of France,
it looked like a set.
It doesn't work, even though it should be easier in some sense, because you know, in theory, if you were filming a movie, you would go film it in Monaco or something.
Yeah, because it just looks so unnatural compared to what's like in the future. Who knows what's natural
exactly.
in the future?
So it works. The ecosystem of the future elements works, but when they go back into the past, it doesn't necessarily match up so well. I mean, we see some of that in the, you know, TOS, like in A Piece of the Action, which is a great episode, and it's got great costumes and great sets. But you can see that is the back lot of the Desi Lu of the NBC sets, where it's like, that's the Chicago set and that's the Chicago car, and those are the outfits for the gangsters, and they picked that at time era because they had those costumes already, because they were already filming some other movie or TV show that used those costumes, right? That's where, and you get that here as well, especially in the scene with Duchamp's, well, played by Worf, you know, Michael Dorn.
Did he, when he spat that powder, that cigar powder?
He didn't spit it. He blew through the cigar.
Like if you blow on those bubblegum cigarettes that they don't sell anymore. I can't believe what
you can still find them if you know where to look.
Yeah, but they were so...
I know a guy in D.C. who can get you some of those.
Oh, yeah, you can hook it up?
Yeah, I can hook you up.
They had paper on them.
I can't believe...
Yeah, paper and little sugar dust
in
them.
Yeah, I can't believe as a kid we would just walk around recess blowing sugar dust tight. Out of them. Yeah, that, it's kind of hard to believe. But anyways...
They all had about one blow.
Yeah, one good blow.
They had like one and a half blow. Yeah, it was gum. It was gum. Yeah. Usually gum.
So I don't.
Or sometimes just cigarettes. Sometimes it was just cigarettes.
Yeah. Just cigarettes.
At first time, I was convinced this was happening, but upon repeated viewings, I wasn't so sure. It looked like after Worf shot that powder out, it looked like some of it hit him too. Like his character Duchamp. It looks like his character kind of like was what's the word when you're wobbly? You know, your face.
Oh, you mean you think he actually acted as if he was being affected by it?
Yeah,
I thought you just mean the prop.
No,
backfired
a little bit. I thought
whammy. He got whammied.
He got whammied. He got, you know, he was, you know, in Mortal Kombat when it says finish him and they're all dazed.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it looked like he, for a second, was acting like he got hit with his own poison. Duchamp did. But then I watched a couple, the second time, and I watched that scene over, and I think I was just imagining things.
You were imagining.
I was imagining. I said a word wrong.
No, I'm not making fun of you.
I said a word wrong.
You coined a new phrase, my friend. You coined a new phrase, imagining.
Jason
Momoa.
It's a memory. It's imagination from your memory.
It's a collage of memories. A
collagerie.
A collagerie.
The menagerie.
Speaking of clothes in the 60s, that was an ugly ass jacket they put on Garrick. That was like,
why did they choose that? Because he shows up in a tuxedo and they put him in some fucking bizarre ass pattern.
Yeah, and then what's that fucking? There's a term for that effect you get on the TV when
moir
you have
pattern. It's called a moir pattern.
Okay, where it's like where it looks all flippity, like it's animated colors or something.
Yeah, because the algorithms go hippity hoppity and start making everything all wavily woobly.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are technical.
It's
things.
It's amazing when people still use that, because we're all fully aware that that happens, but people choose to put it in shows anyway.
It also shows up at different resolutions. So when people were making television programs in the 1990s, they believed they were targeting their whatever it was, 560
okay.
whatever lines
okay.
of resolution.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
560
I got it. Didn't Worf's seat look fucking cramped as fuck when they were like on that flight back?
Say what?
Before they got blowed up.
Michael Dorn.
It looked like they were all sitting in the same fucking seat.
Yeah, they looked like they were a commercial flight.
And Michael Dorn's a pilot. He regularly flies around places.
Oh, really?
If you want to hear some great stories.
Is he a jet setter? No, those are people who. Jet setter seems like such an old school term.
It is.
It's for people from the
1960s.
It's from people who ride jets a lot
because they're
rich. When
jets were new. Yeah.
Check out Gates McFadden's podcast. She has a podcast where she interviews a lot of Star Trek folks, and her episodes with Michael Dorn are, I think she did two episodes with him. He tells some great stories from Star Trek, but also from some funny stories that happened to him while he was flying.
I'm still serious. They should make a movie where Dr. Crusher and Worf go back into
medieval
times and get in, like, you know,
ninja stuff.
Ninja
samurai samurai business.
I mean, you could have that involved too.
Pirates.
I was thinking more like big broadswords,
jousting,
and broadswords. Yeah. But you could mix
Middle Ages England sort of thing.
Yeah, but you know what? Mix in some Eastern stuff too. You know,
why not
Benedict Cumberbatch?
Maybe it's a TV show and they go from time period to time period.
That's called Quantum Leap.
No. But I don't mean they're not leaping into other people's bodies. Maybe they go to one time period, but then they travel the world. So they go to the Middle Eastern England, then onto mainland Europe, and then through Tsarist Russia. And then they go to the East and meet up with samurai, Shogun.
They'll meet up with Robin Hood and Worf. And then Gates McFadden will go, I am not a merry woman.
Robin Hood is not a historical figure.
Robin Hood's not real.
That TNG.
King Arthur's not real either.
Well, I mean, you know.
Well, you know what
I'm not
saying.
You're the one who said it had to be historical. I'm not saying it has to be historical.
Oh.
I know you're not saying that, but I am saying
I'm offering my own spin.
You're talking about a more.
We can each pitch these ideas to the.
Surreal sort of.
They could meet dinosaur dragons.
Yes. Okay. I see.
Why not just regular dragons or dinosaurs? Why does it have to be a dinosaur dragon?
I don't know, because it seemed cool.
I mean, it does sound kind of cool.
Sky's the limit, man. Sky's the limit.
Yeah, this guy is the limit.
You just got to set the ground rules. This guy's the limit.
The sky. You got to set the ground rules for the sky. You got to set the ground rules for the sky. Miss Mona loves it.
I know, right?
She can fly a plane.
Another male gaze thing, quote unquote, excused by the conceit.
Yeah,
of the
right.
Was she even wearing pants? I couldn't tell.
She was wearing a skirt suit, I believe.
That is
true. It's like, how far can you go with that excuse? It's like, oh, this is how they viewed people in that time. Yeah. We're just trying to make it. It's Rick Berman's excuse to like be creepy about it.
You can totally do that if you do sufficient countering of that through clever plot mechanics. And they do a little bit with Major Kira. Or the character she plays with. It's not Nabokov. It's not Romanov. It's they do a little bit in terms of her being a capable person. She's a spy. Although you could argue that by placing her character in the Eastern context, that is a meta excuse for why you have an empowered woman, because the Russians would do things like that. The Russians were the first to have women in space, for example. The Russians were
women soldiers.
The Soviets, I should say, were much earlier in terms of integrating military positions.
They could probably vote.
You could write a bunch of papers about the placement and hierarchy and structure of characters in this episode, because it didn't have to be Garrick being tagging along with Bashir. It could have been somebody else. However, in the context of the show, in the context of the characterizations, Garrick is perfect. Bashir and Garrick have a pre-existing relationship. Bashir and Garrick have this push and pull over where Bashir is jealous of Garrick's experience, real world experience as a spy, something that Bashir has shown a previous interest in. Garrick being madly in love with Bashir, and that's just plainly clear. And so that does make for an interesting dynamic. So I'm willing to excuse some of the 90s nonsense in this episode, and some of it's pretty serious, including the whole Dax business. And it's funny because in the case of Dax in Deep Space Nine is an independent, intelligent, powerful, strong character, and she is diminished in her role as Honey Bear. And by the way, note that Honey Bear is spelled B-A-R-E. As in, like,
oh, why did he even fucking
like bare ass, right? Oh, you know, man. That sort of thing, right? Bare as in nudity,
as in bare ass naked,
very overtly sexualized, very she's all thatted, or My Fair Lady, or Pygmalion, or whatever. But you know, it's really she's all that, and this is pre she's all that in terms of
she's all that with spots.
You take off your glasses, you let down your hair, and now you're gorgeous.
Now you're gorgeous,
yeah, and now I'm gonna kiss you.
This chick would be really hot if she wasn't wearing glasses.
Now that's why I was wondering if Garrick was groaning because it was such a trope, or if it was just simply because he's hitting on her. Or I don't know. Were they self-aware of the fact that they were going for that bullshit, like take off the glasses thing?
I think they were.
He doesn't want to see Bashir kissing some lady.
Yeah, he doesn't.
But
need to
I was wondering
that.
If it was like a meta
it's
sort of.
It's going
to
disrupt his
thing.
Fantasies.
I was wondering if it was a meta commentary.
It's messing with it.
It could be a little bit. The thing is it's so slight that it's not strong enough, maybe. But I think there's multiple commentaries there. It's commenting on the trope. Although Garrick himself may not be probably isn't familiar with the trope, because he is not familiar with 1960s Earth, human, Western.
He knows about 1960s Cardassia.
Yeah. Which is all stories
all
about.
Swinging.
All their novels are just about families, and the same thing happens over and over.
It's the same as 1860s Cardassia.
When Kira was talking about like the mission, you know, they just saw Kira for the first time, and she was talking about how there's a series of earthquakes.
So many earthquakes
have struck cities from Vladivostok to New York. By the way, do you know where
New York? It's in the north.
Is it
near
the Pacific?
It's all point. It's on the pointy part up at the top.
No,
is that up in the Arctic?
No, Vladivostok is about 19 miles southeast of Blagoveshchensk.
Okay. So I get the joke he was getting. I know. I should have predicted this. It's
you
a good
son
joke.
Of a bitch.
It's a very good joke.
What?
I should have predicted it. It was well executed. He successfully tricked both you and I, Jesse, into this.
I was nerding out.
But it's good, you know?
Say it again. What were the words you said?
Vladivostok is about 19 hours southeast of Blagoveshchensk.
Yeah. So what he's done is he's taken another locality up in the north, significantly further north as it happens, and in asking us where it is relative to other things.
Oh,
he's chosen an obscure small town.
He's a son of a bitch.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, I was being a little bit more diplomatic than that, but you're right.
Okay, well.
Well done, sir.
But as it were, it's more on the southeast side, both of them.
I'm mixing up my geography. Is that on
southeast relative to fucking what?
Is that on the Arctic Ocean or the Pacific Ocean?
It's on the Sea of Japan.
Okay.
It's near North Korea.
That was what I thought. I thought it was on the, like, that
It's
coast.
One of the ones they fight with. Yeah. They fight with each other over.
Right.
Japan is all like, that's ours. And Russia's like, nah, man, that's ours.
Is it like Kamchatka?
It's like nothing. Nobody needs to be there.
I can't remember where Kamchatka is. I think Black Ovation
is because Kamchatka is about 150 miles east of Kombucha.
Okay. Ah, very funny. I think it's, oh yeah, Black Ovation.
Eumenides.
Black Ovation.
Euripides.
Euripides and nuts off.
So Vladivostok is northeast of North Korea and kind of like next to China. And Black Ovation is also right, like directly next to China.
What about Slavonsk Manchuria. Or Vanuatu?
Is it actually Manchuria?
What?
The part of China.
It's China.
Is it Inner Mongolia?
Yeah, but you got to remember, Jesse's only a fan of maps that are like pre-1950.
Yeah, it has to be like from...
he's only familiar with like Indochina, 30, Manchuria.
31, 32.
It's near...
This guy's always talking about Rhodesia, if you know what I mean. This know, guy's always... Jesse's always on about Rhodesia.
I think what like how we go to
German Sud-West Africa.
How we go to Tijuana over the weekends on in North America. They go.
We do.
Yeah, they go to they go to that? They go to they go to China.
People in San Antonio
on the weekend. People in Black Ovations go to China to buy like tongue salad and dresses and stuff. I'm not making that up. Someone actually told me that.
Our man Bashir.
Was that what we were talking about?
Right.
Once upon a time.
A few minutes ago.
So yeah, we see this sort of progression of Garrick. At first, he's talking to Bashir as if he's teaching him some kind of lesson about life, where he's like, you know, what he says.
He doesn't understand the context. The lesson for Garrick is that there is real world spycraft, and then there is the context of this fictional construct. That's not a heavy thing they lay down in this episode, but that is part of it, right? Is that Garrick is thinking about things in terms of, I'm an actual spy. I know how actual spy shit works, and actual spies do not live in penthouse apartments and fucking Hong
Kong. Because they don't really watch movies on Cardassia, or if they do, it's about like the same old stuff every time. It's
Cardassian literature about, and I'm sure their movies are the same. It's all about, you know, seven generations of a single family, and the exact same thing happens like in repetition. Because
right.
Like Garrick's always talking about how repetition is like the core of like Cardassian literature, and Bashir
just,
is always like, this real fucking boring.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Reinforcing like a specific, whatever the lesson is. So Garrick is thinking as a spy, and Bashir is like, that's not what you're supposed to do here. We're in a holodeck program.
But now when they find out the safeties are turned off, when they were talking about assassinating executing O'Brien.
Yeah.
And that's when he was like, yo, this is for real now.
Yes.
But he wasn't seeming that worried yet. He was more like being like, you know, Bashir, one of these days you're going to have to make a choice.
One of these days you're going to have to shoot your friend in the fucking back.
Yeah, right. And then it climaxes with like, what is it? Bashir goes, it's my fantasy, trust me. And Garrick's like, no, this has gone far enough. You know, and the way he says no.
He's fed up. I mean, he's fed up. He's like, I don't want to fucking die in a laser cave explosion.
It's almost like a temper tantrum, except it's like fed up. It's like, no, fuck you, man. That's it. And you can tell
this shit is for real.
Yeah, at first it was like Garrick was being kind of like, you know, giving advice and stuff. And this time
I know when to walk away.
Yeah, this time he's like, no, you're actually fucking my shit up now. And you can tell Garrick's getting worried.
And Bashir gets to prove himself a little bit hard.
Yeah.
A little bit hard this episode, because he shoots Bashir.
Shoots him in the neck.
Ends up just shooting him in the neck. And of course, Garrick is like, oh, I'm glad you aimed for, you know, a grazing shot. And Bashir's like, I wasn't fucking aiming. I was trying to fucking murder your ass.
Yeah.
To save the other people.
And then.
And then thick Cardassian neck.
Yeah. And then Garrick goes, I do believe there's hope for you yet. And then Bashir is like, I'm so relieved. Like that exchange right there is kind of like the perfect. That's the real climax of
it.
And
it's also because you've got these two brilliant actors in Andrew Robinson and Alexander Siddig, who are both really, 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 really good. And they're always good no matter what they do, no matter how light and fluffy their particular role is. But in this episode, in that specific scene, you have Andrew Robinson really sincerely conveying a rise in respect for Dr. Bashir, somebody who he already respected, he already liked, and in fact is in love with. And then Alexander Siddig, in response, is able to display simultaneously both his relief that the situation has been diffused, his further relief that his friend and erstwhile potential lover, Garrick, is not dead, right? Because his aim wasn't that great because he's a fucking doctor. and the exhaustion of just dealing with the situation, right? Like all of that together is expressed in Alexander Siddig's response, you know, in Bashir's response to Garrick, where he's just like, fine, fuck, whatever. Let's fucking, can we just go now?
Yeah.
I've proved my point. You've proved your point. Whatever. And let's go.
And then Garrick, the when he says, who am I to question Julian Bashir, secret agent, lead on. Like, that was like, I actually laughed out loud there because it's such like an inspiring moment because it's funny, but it's also like Garrick truly is like, it's funny how you have to like get deep with someone, get into some deep shit with someone sometimes before they respect you. And that's such a weird concept because people's urge is like, no, I got to be nice to everyone all the time. That way, you know, I'm a good person and they'll respect me. And yes, you don't want to be an asshole, but there are times that people are going to respect you more if you dig back, if you like push back and say, and
shoot
no,
them in
man.
The fucking neck.
Yeah. So it's
Garrick did not protect the neck.
So this is why it's a good thing to push all the buttons of a person right when you meet them.
This is Dan's, by the way, for new listeners, this is Dan's ongoing theory of social interaction.
So
he suggests that if you meet a new person, you should aggravate them, disgust them, whatever your particular personality traits are, do it to the extreme to scare away any people who are not able to handle.
Well, that's handle an interesting you. Way of putting it
that's
into context.
That's how I interpret it. I mean, feel free to correct me if I'm incorrect.
Well, it's not to assert dominance. That's not
at all.
Not at all.
I agree.
That's not.
It's not
just
a dominance.
It's just to find their limit. If you reach that limit,
it's a filtering mechanism.
You know how far to take it when you reach that limit. If you show respect after that person, you know, if someone comes up to you and they like, let's say I come up to a new person, I push all their buttons.
Okay, I'll play the new person. I'm the new person. Hi, Dan. My name's Daryl. How are you doing?
Don't fucking talk to me like that.
Okay. Daryl. Okay. You know? Seem like a fun guy. What are your hobbies?
You know, I like doing cool stuff. Do you like doing cool stuff?
He likes to frown a lot.
Dan did teach me how to frown, and he's a smiley guy, but he taught me how to frown. You know, I didn't know how to work those muscles before, but in high school, he showed me which muscles to use in order to frown.
It's really so, it's not something that I will instigate. It's if they instigate me first. If they say something simple like, hey, can you go pick that up or something like that? That's when
like,
you go,
why don't you go fuck yourself, you piece of shit.
Yeah. You say like, if they ask you in a disrespectful tone, you can just say, you fucking pick it up or something like that.
I think it's always a disrespectful tone.
Yeah, yeah. If somebody's trying to assert their dominance, you just push it. You don't just defend against it. You push back and you take something seemingly meaningless and turn it into a big deal.
Seemingly meaningless sounds like a great name for an album.
Yeah, seemingly.
Not a band name, but an album name for real.
Yeah, seemingly not many people come up with album names. They usually
screamingly
use band
weemulous.
Name. So basically, if you show respect at, like, if you push that person's buttons and they're super pissed off of you, if I do that to you, if then after I piss you off, I show you respect, then you're more likely to respect me. You see what I'm saying? Because like you
it's
from
a
your
two-way street.
Because you're from your perspective, you're like, this guy's fucking pushing my buttons. And I'm yelling at him now. And like, oh, he's showing me respect. I expected that I would yell at him and he would yell at me and we just start yelling at each other. But no, he immediately showed respect. Kind of like, and so you tend to respect each other more if you come back from that situation alive. You know what I mean? Otherwise, you just part ways, and it's better to find out now than like 5 years down the road, right? So why put this shit off for 5 years down the road? Why waste time on that relationship?
I think it's important to
It's like getting
out.
Into a small, intense, like romantic relationship with somebody for about 5 minutes. Without the sex.
I think it's
or the love.
It's important to point out that both myself, Patrick, and Jesse over here, we have survived this particular filter with Dan. Many have not. there is a stream of bodies in the wake of Dan. But we have survived, and that's part of what makes this podcast so great, is that Dan's not immediately going to murder us.
It's like Sparta, training for Sparta to be a Spartan or something.
Yeah.
This is Sparta. Yeah. This is Farta. That's what I call it.
It's gladiator training. It's,
I'm not Sparta, I'm Farta.
Yeah.
Farta after eating all those
Squirta.
Pickles.
So
Squirtle.
Squirtle.
We do need to start wrapping up
some things. Oh, we totally should.
Things soon, but
you said but.
A couple
that's
key
where,
points.
That's
we
where poop
we
comes
talked
from.
About Honey Bear. There's not much to talk about there with Dax. I mean, overly.
Dr. Noah.
It was funny. It was overly sexualized. Yeah, we'll get to Dr. Noah in a second. Nabokov, Ramonov, Kamananov.
Did you notice Worf's cigar?
The Meriwether.
Worf had a yellow. The yellow label meant it was a good cigar. The red label meant it was a bad cigar.
Yeah, and he also really gripped those. He was not good at lighting those cigars. He was all like furiously lighting the cigar and like all looking at it and sort of holding it like with his giant hands.
Yeah,
Klingons don't know how to smoke.
He also wasn't particularly good at Baccarat, so that was also funny. But Worf's character was good. I mean, all these it's all
shit.
Lightness. It's all lightness and fluffiness.
Totally.
Like I said, not much with the Dax character. O'Brien's character, the Falcon, was hilarious
because
the joke was that it was a one note character.
Yeah.
Cole Meany,
that bird on his iPad.
Cole Meany is always great, but it is again. It's a one note character. He's not doing much.
I like how O'Brien was like immediately a dick when they came back from transporting. He's like, "What'd you do to my ship?"
Yeah, Eddington was worried about that,
right?
But yeah, so we must talk about Dr. Noah.
Yeah.
First, let's get it out of the way right at the beginning. It's a great joke on the 1960s sort of on the noseness. Where Dr. Noah wants to flood the
and it's his name is like Hippocrates Noah,
which is the father of medicine. So is it like he's the he's using genocide as medicine? Is that kind of like what the implication is? Because
he wants to heal the world.
Yeah, he wants to heal the world through flood.
And he's also hypocritical.
Yeah,
in a sense,
the ego on this guy.
He's a
this
genocide.
Guy had
versus
a fucking
the,
ego.
The other Noah with the. With the Ark, who's saving,
who didn't cause the flood, and right? You know, he's the biblical Noah, who I do not think you will find the wreckage of the Ark on Mount Ararat, as some people believe, but the biblical Noah was told by God to build a boat. And he did.
He named his son Ham.
And that's what he's doing out of an island. He's literally building an island boat.
There's a joke on the internet where God says, I want you to build a big fucking boat. And Noah's like, do you mean a big, like a really big boat or a big boat for fucking? And then God is like, why not both? You know, two of every creature. In this case, Dr. Noah, played by Avery Brooks, he wanted to cause the flood. He wasn't trying to rescue anybody.
Yeah.
He wanted to make Mount Everest.
He was rescuing his own hand-picked people. But Avery Brooks is always wonderful, and he is great. And as much as we complimented Kate Mulgrew and the other cast last week, because they really had so much fun in Bride of Chaotica and getting into it, nobody got into it as much, in my opinion, as Avery Brooks.
Totally. He gave the laugh, the sort of
that funny laugh.
Was that when he was holding lemonade on the beach in that other in the first episode? I can't remember if he was holding
Jennifer.
Lemonade at the
yeah,
time.
Yeah,
it was
he's,
Jennifer.
Because that's when he's like walking over the hot sun in the emissary, where he's like, ha, 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 ha.
Well, he just goes, ha, ha, ha.
Hi, I'm Mickey Mouse.
But yeah, he's amazing. He's really is amazing in that.
This is great. I mean, Avery Brooks is amazing, and I had the rare opportunity to go see Avery Brooks live.
Oh, was it Othello?
No, it was Tamburlaine. He was in Christopher Marlowe's Tamburlaine at the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C. And I went, you know, I do like going to see plays. Actual plays are fun to watch.
Not musicals?
I do love fucking musicals. Mm. I love musicals, but I more often will go see a play like a Shakespeare play, Christopher Marlowe. The Shakespeare Company does some really, they do some really great shows, but I will admit I was mostly attracted. I was not very familiar with the play Tamburlaine. I was attracted there because it was Avery Brooks playing Tamburlaine. So I was like, fuck yeah.
Is it like Tamerlane?
Tamerlane, yeah. Where Tamerlane, whatever the correct pronunciation is. And I was attracted to go see it because of Avery Brooks, and it was brilliant. He was great in it. It was great seeing him live. But the main thing about seeing him live is you, and when you see him in interviews, is Avery Brooks is an interesting fella. Mm-hmm. He's a fascinating guy, and he really takes on these roles, and more than any of the other characters, everyone did great. Dana Visitor did great as Kamananov, and because she had the most kind of to do, I think. Mm-hmm. I do think Michael Dorn did a very good job with Duchamps. Dax didn't have much to do with Honey Bear, but you know, what are you going to do? Colmeany was great in what
she
had.
She was these all. She's all that.
She was all that. Colmeany was great, but Avery Brooks really, it's so fun to watch him just inhabit this megalomaniacal genocidal maniac. I would love to see Avery Brooks today as a James Bond villain. I think he would be wonderful.
Yeah,
I think it would be so great. Just have him be this character. Have him be Hippocrates Noah. Have it be this plot line.
When Bashir pressed the button, now I guess what they were trying to express is that when he said, I didn't expect it would actually happen, I guess they were trying to say, oh, he wasn't supposed to win because he's the bad guy. But part of it...
And it's the way the holodeck program is programmed.
And it's like, well, Bashir... And the Bashir broke the AI essentially because if he was going to win that, was going to win, it wasn't going to
He didn't provide the correct inputs.
Yeah, for Bashir, they were like, they didn't like account for the fact that Bashir might press the button, you know.
Exactly. So it's supposed to, as Bashir stated, it's either Honey Bear or Kamananov is supposed to die,
but
depending, and those are the, it's a choose your own adventure, but it's got fairly limited endings,
right? So but I also got this feeling from the way he responded to it, Avery Brooks,
make me respond. There's a Michael Jackson joke.
What?
It was a bit of a non sequitur, I will admit that, but you said the way, you said the way, and that triggered the way you make me feel,
okay.
The way you make me feel. It's a Michael Jackson song, but I wanted to modify it to make sense in the context of the conversation.
It's very, very funny.
No, it's not particularly funny. It didn't really work out.
Okay, so.
We try things.
The way we try things.
We try things.
We throw them at the wall, see if they stick. So Avery Brooks, there's a joke there somewhere, I'm sure. Avery Brooks, but the way Avery Brooks responded to Bashir pressing the button, it almost seemed like he was sad and disappointed that he didn't get to press the button.
I think so.
Because
you would want to press the fucking button, right?
Yeah, because it was his thing.
That was his thing, because right when he was talking to Bashir, he's like saying, but then he goes, what is it you understand, Mr. Bashir, that you should have killed me when you had the chance? I agree, but then again, I suppose it wouldn't be very, very heroic. I, on the other hand, have no pretensions about the idea of being a hero. And then he points the gun at Bashir. He has no pretensions about the idea of being a hero, but he has pretensions of its cousin, which is like narcissism and just like the classic
impacting.
He wants to be the one to impact. He doesn't want to be thought of as a hero, but he does want to be worshipped.
Yes.
He wants to be worshipped, but not like a hero. He wants everyone to bow down to him, kind of deal. And so that's the idea. If somebody else presses that button for you, it's kind of disappointing. It's like, I wanted to press the button.
I agree. I think that what's nice about this is on the one hand, these characters are presented as extremely arch. Mm-hmm. Extremely arch in terms of
Noah's Ark.
They're the thinnest of archetypes that they're occupying. And that's part of the joke. That's part of the fun. But at the same time, and I think it's partly because of the contributions that Avery Brooks gives to the character. With the character of Dr. Noah, it is an arch character, but he still adds to it. He still adds all that sort of ethos and pathos to the character in the sense that he wants to impact the world. Mm-hmm. And you get the impression with the limited information we have that he could impact the world in a number of ways. But he's like, this is how I can really fucking impact the world. He keeps referring
to. You farted while you said that.
I did, because I was on like.
Was that what that was? That was
it was a mouth fart. But he once he keeps referring to the second human race. Right?
Yeah.
And I was immediately, my brain was immediately quibbling with him. Was like, well, actually, it's a continuation because it's simply a bottleneck. And there was another bottleneck about a number of thousands of years ago. There was another bottleneck. There were the number of humans. It was possibly only 1,100 on the planet. And possibly also related to flooding because of glacial melt. That being left aside, the fact is that he's an interesting villain because he's engaging. And he's convincing, right? When Bashir is talking, you know, Bashir is trying to buy time, right? Our Bashir. But the character of Bashir, you know, is agreeing with Dr. Noah and saying, yes, the world is complicated, is overly complicated, has too many people, and this and that, and that, and that. And
And the thing that's great about it is just you buy it. You can buy it. You even if you've watched this episode a million times like we have, and you know exactly how it's going to end, Alexander Siddig's portrayal and the character of Bashir's logic is sound. It's a classic example of a convincing. It's a horrible argument. It's an evil argument, but it's convincing. And I liked seeing that because it wasn't simple, right? Because part of the shittiness about the evil of the world is understanding that it's because people can make arguments that sound really good. It sounds really sensible in some ways. For a brief moment, your brain can comprehend, you know what? Maybe we should flood the whole planet and all hang out on Mount Everest with a bunch of geniuses. Now, if you examine that idea a little bit more thoroughly from moral and logical dimensions, it's ridiculous and evil, right? But you can understand that that gate opening to how that makes sense. And
or what about even like the plates settling and that's what causes the flood because
it's a little ridiculous, maybe.
The surface area is shrinking.
No, it's because they're like letting out the magma. There's some logical, right. There's some things that don't quite work out.
Yeah, I was wondering how accurate that science was, where if you shoot lasers into the center of the earth, it will cause like oozing volcanoes everywhere that flood the earth with magma, which makes the earth shrink. I'm wondering if there's any accuracy.
My expertise.
That's a lot of fucking magma.
I mean, why would they just make that up though?
My expertise is not in geology.
The magma would cover everything.
Sounds like a boatload of bullshit to me, because if you're letting the magma out to sink things when the magma spread out,
the magma's going to cover.
And by the way, there's an easier thing they could have done. There's an easier setup they could have set up, which is just melt the fucking ice caps.
Yeah.
Point the lasers at the north.
Well, maybe
and
this
south
is how Waterworld actually happened, is from this episode of Star Trek.
Okay, so everyone in the audience, Dan recently rewatched Waterworld.
Part of Waterworld.
So he's bringing up analogies about Waterworld.
Nobody watches all of Waterworld.
It's like his new thing.
I've never seen any of Waterworld.
It has Tina Margarino in it.
I don't know who that
who is.
Who is
that?
But I saw.
That sounds cool.
I saw Waterworld once. I saw it in
sounds
the theaters.
Like a cool name.
I saw it in the
she
theaters.
Was,
Deb, it was one of those early disappointments.
Yeah, this early disappointment.
Oh, she was
like
in
Napoleon
Dynamite.
She was Deb.
All right.
So we agree that Hippocrates Noah. He was creating an ark out of the land island that he was creating by shooting.
Yeah, he was like on fucking Mount Everest. He built a cabin, a nice big mansion.
Where was the island?
Like a retreat.
But where was the island paradise going to be?
Wasn't an island. It was like
the top of the mountain.
It was like top of the mountain.
It's
going
to turn into an island, which
it becomes an island.
Which is his ark, which is his boat.
Yeah.
And he's called Hippocrates because
there's not a boat, it's an island.
But I mean, it's the equivalent of a boat.
It's the equivalent of
an ark. And he's Hippocrates because he
causes the problem instead of like
the Hippocrates is the father of medicine. It's like the Hippocratic
Oath. Yeah, but
oath.
It's also the term hypocritical.
I think
it's a play on words. I think the DS9 writers are exceptionally clever and intelligent.
It's like hypocritical.
Both of those meanings are at play.
Yeah,
here.
I just took it to mean that he's healing man or humankind through destruction and flooding and murder.
He believes he is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But he's assuming that Everest is still going to be taller once the surface area of
he's done the calculations.
He's done the fucking calculations.
He's had his boffins at work. His boffins at work.
Them boffins.
His boffins.
Boffin it
that's
up.
That's a UK term for scientist. In America, we call it scientist, but in UK, they call it a boffin.
I like when Garrick said,
I think we call them nerds.
Kiss the girl, get the key. They never taught me in that.
Yeah, well, that's because Cardass is all fucked up.
Kiss the girl.
Kiss the girl, get the key. They never taught me that in the Obsidian Order. That's a pretty badass.
Insidious Order.
That's an awesome name, the Obsidian Order.
Yeah.
And Kiss the Girl, get the key.
I think it's better than the Tal Shiar or the Section 31.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, Obsidian Order is like kind of, they're like the best and most badass. Yeah. Except they Nabrentain kind of. Took him on the wrong path.
I also like the ending where he said, indulging in fantasy keeps the mind creative. I think that's a good quote. I think that's solid philosophy.
I think it's a good quote. Yeah. I think it's good advice.
Yeah.
I think all our listeners should go out and do something fantastical today.
I thought it was bullshit.
And then the next day.
I thought it was bullshit when Garrick had enough and he was going to like leave the holosuite. In TNG, they would just say, computer, arch, and the arch would appear. But he was like, computer, show me the mechanism in which you can, you know.
He's getting a little ridiculous.
He's like giving like, Bashir all kinds of time to shoot
bag,
him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Giving Bashir time to fuck his shit up. Anyway. But yeah, indulging in fantasy keeps the mind creative. I think that's an important thing for people to remember when they talk about, why do you waste your time in that bullshit all day? It's like, well,
why do you waste your time in the real world all day?
Yeah, who gave you ownership of what's not bullshit? And why do you get to, like, full meal with that bullshit, you know?
I
fuck
agree.
You. I'm fucking, this helps me go to sleep sometimes because it makes me go to a fun world and where exactly. I can think about fun things.
Exactly.
I don't have to think about how, like, the sun is gonna make me go blind if I look at it or some shit like
don't
that.
Don't look at the sun.
Don't do it.
Yeah. In addition to being nominated for the Best Music Emmy for Best Music in a Series Emmy, this was also nominated for Best Hairstyling. Okay. Or Outstanding Hairstyling.
Yep.
So, yeah. That works. Bashir uses a blue steel Walther PPK, which is
that's a Bond gun.
Accurate to both the period and similar to the gun that Bond uses. Mm-hmm. Although Dr. Noah uses a somewhat anachronistic gun, he has a Walther PPK as well. However, his is a stainless steel, but those were not available mm-hmm. until the 1980s. Now, certain nitpickers might say, you know what? That's ridiculous. Why would he be using a 1980s weapon in the 1960s, in 1964?
Because he's stupid.
Now, I say, because Dr. Noah, you know, he's ahead of the curve. Yeah. Right? He's riding that wave of technological knowledge, slurping up all those best, you know, the best scientists.
He
the
got
world.
Him from the aliens.
He knows what's up. They might have only been publicly available in the 1980s, but in the 1960s, maybe Dr. Noah, he's got one of them prototype like, Walther PPKs.
It's like when that
stainless steel.
It's like in Star Trek when that village got Velcro. Remember, they got it from an alien
from Carbon Creek. And it wasn't a village. I believe it was Pittsburgh.
I believe
T'Pol's grandmother traveled to Pittsburgh by train.
Yeah.
And even at that time, because it was the 1950s, it was not a village.
Those PPK guns take like funny shaped rounds, from what I remember.
I think you can get them in 38.
They're like long and skinny rounds.
I think you can get 38 and 32 caliber. Yeah. Versions of the Walther PPK. I always wanted a Walther PPK.
This the whole idea of transporters goes hand in hand with holodeck for like sort of this exploration into sort of it's an inadvertent existential revelation apparent in those two devices, you know, because you can get stuck in the transporter buffer and we've seen all sorts of things happen with that and the holodeck. It's like, what is life? You know, you're storing putting the human soul.
Because they totally died. Like,
yeah,
and like their ship got exploded.
Well, that's the whole message of Star Trek has always been that life is a bunch of bullshit. And just don't fucking care about shit because it's a bunch of bullshit.
Don't think too hard about that.
Nobody's real. It's all made up. It's all useless and ridiculous.
They put our soul inside the fucking DS9, a Cardassian ship. Our souls are like haunting the DS9 ship.
It's a Cardassian space station.
Okay, sorry, you're right. My bad.
It's not a ship.
I just wanted to stave off any fucking YouTube comments and letters.
I actually appreciate that. And the soul is handled at the quantum level, which the game Mass Effect, which I bring up a lot, it does something similar with their android minds. They keep referring to a quantum box. So science has a lot of mysteries that mirror sort of certain, you know, spiritual ideals, except they're not presented spiritually. They're presented scientifically through evidence. So, but it's interesting that a lot of these ideas that science takes on is not too much different than what religion is trying to answer in some cases, not in all cases. Science gets its shit through, you know, evidence, and science is actually more just about what's practical. What's going to, like, is this useful to know? You know, basically stuff like that.
Some shit you can't find out through science. Science knows that.
Yeah, so it's right. So when I say like it's like
the rest of it is Q. It's always Q.
Like the idea that
one of the Q. Somebody from the Q.
One of those
continuum.
Other Qs.
Kind of like the idea how shit randomly like pops in and out of our universe and randomness comes from at the quantum level. That shit's like some weird spiritual sounding shit when you think about it, but it's not. It's based on evidence. So
there's like the Corbin Burnson Q, and there's like that other girl Q.
Yeah, there's the Olivia Dabo. It's Olivia Dabo. Her mother was Miriam Dabo, who was in that James Bond movie.
Oh, is it? There's Olivia Dabo?
Olivia Dabo Q is the daughter Q. She doesn't know she's a Q, and then she finds out that she's a Q, and then Q comes to train her or kill her. That's a good one.
That's right.
And her mother was in James Bond with Timothy Dalton, and she plays a Russian cellist.
Am I right about that? That like randomness is sort of introduced on the quantum level. Like, isn't that what they
say? I think so.
That's what, because
it's a complicated. That's a complicated.
It's really complicated.
The concept of randomness is complicated.
Well, that's the thing. The whole concept of randomness is it doesn't really exist, except the only way they can account for it is on the quantum level. I'm not sure how. I don't understand all that. But like everything is affected.
Why
by something.
Why don't you read a book?
So,
they got a thing called books.
I was playing video games all the time.
I mean, you think about like with programming, there's no such thing on a computer as a random number. Nothing is random. So, but there is.
Yeah, but that's a function of the architecture of how a computer works.
Yeah, which mirrors a lot of ways in how other things function.
But it's a simplified version.
And so
randomness is
a layer upon a layer.
So there's philosophy that argues that if you know sufficient amount of information, you can predict like everything that's going to happen in the future.
That's a deterministic, except quantum mechanics suggests that a deterministic universe does not, in fact, exist.
That's what I was getting at. Precisely. Is because of that, right?
And playing into that are the multiple universes possibility. Where there's every quantum choice that's possible has been made, and there's parallel universes.
You could always bend numbers to suit you. Numbers can always, you just.
Just bend them right over.
You can make them do whatever you want.
I was just fascinated by the idea why so many people seem to equate like the human soul with quantum stuff. If it's just kind of bullshit, or if it's just the idea it's the force of change in the universe that sort of causes things to happen in a non-deterministic fashion.
It's a cultural artifact, in my view. It's a cultural artifact in that when you.
When I say soul, I don't literally mean
No, I understand that. I understand what you're saying, but I do think it's an interesting topic, and it does tangentially relate to things like the transporter and stuff. If you have something that you don't fully understand, and then you are caught sometimes between, let's put it another way, right? You see a receding of religion to a certain degree in a lot of areas, but it's being supplanted by things like conspiracy theories or a generic spirituality that is less doctrinistic, but then applies things to pseudoscientific interpretations of things like quantum mechanics, which are very difficult to fully understand in any meaningful way for the lay person, but they appear as an access point for some amount of magic in that I don't understand what that is, so that is the box within which I can now place all the things I don't understand about how life works. I can place it within that box, and even though that box does not explicitly explain anything, it is a framework that I can place an assumption on that it does somehow manage whatever it is that I'm talking about. And then that allows people to interpret it in whatever broad array that works for them and sort of settles that anxiety in the back of their mind about, I kind of need to understand that things work a certain way.
Right. And that's kind of what religion goes for too. And a lot is to settle anxiety. Although ironically, religion causes so much anxiety.
That's receded somewhat because of some of the tenets of religion are no longer compatible with people's understanding of reality. Mm-hmm. So they have to replace it with something.
Yeah.
Or they want to replace it with something, quantum mechanics or whatever.
So there's an admission that, so stuff that's unknown in science isn't magical. It's just we don't know it yet, or maybe we won't. Who knows? The idea is it'd be nice to think you can figure everything out. But at the same time, yes, what you're saying is you're basically admitting that some of this stuff, theory about, the universe, origins of universe and quantum mechanics and things like that, some of it is based simply in sort of a framework that helps us understand the Earth, that it's not necessarily useful or productive or even real.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's real, but it's like...
It's real!
It's fake! Okay. I think that's a good place to start.
It's got philosophy.
Yeah. Does the true way come back? The true way that Cardassian...
I think they do. I think they come up because they the true way, Dan's referencing the people who sabotaged or claimed to sabotage the runabout that got us into this whole ridiculous mess in the first place. They do come up because they start to destabilize. They're one of the factors that are destabilizing the Cardassian government. And remember, this is season four. So as things move along forward, we're going to see the Cardassians dealing, you know, there's going to be associations with the Romulans, with the Dominion, the Obsidian Order going rogue and doing all these things. So we're basically seeing the beginnings of the crumbling of the Cardassian government, which up to this point has at least appeared externally to be a relatively stable, relatively powerful force to deal with, right? The Federation was at war with them for a long time, finally reached an armistice. They pulled back to their territory, but now we're just having to deal with them all the time because instead of fighting them ship to ship, we got to hang out with them at like bars and stuff, and they're just aggravating us with their arrogance and their long stories about bullshit.
They don't drink root beer.
What do you do with the degraded pattern from a transporter? Is it useless?
Yeah,
or can you can
you just
set us up?
I wish that would have been.
What do you do with a degraded transporter buffer pattern?
Do you think you can like put it back into people form, but it makes them look all fucked up and they're like, "Kill me"?
Charisma's in her jaw.
Something horrible. Yeah, like horrible glitches.
Or everything's just a little like rumbly and bumpy.
You ever seen those like it's like those video game glitches where the face is all torn asunder in some weird polygonal way. Yeah, so I was wondering if they're completely useless or if you can kind of make a monster out of them. Can you squish all the patterns together to create a super person?
I'm sure you could, and I'm sad that Star Trek hasn't done more with that. I mean, we did see fucking Tuvix.
Yeah, Tuvix.
Which is basically, and there's a flower involved there too. And the great thing about the end of Tuvix is they do end up splitting Tuvix back into Neelix and Tuvok, but where's the fucking flower? Because it was originally Tuvok, Neelix, and the flower.
That's a good point. Yeah. I didn't even think about that. Yeah. All right. So,
any last bits and pieces here? Any last odds and ends?
No.
They just need to do more research into this holodeck and transporter technology that could like really change the face of humanity as we know it.
Maybe that'll be Discovery season four. December season four, everyone's gonna be like, you know what? I was thinking about
think
it.
Of all these things that happen.
Transporters some fucked up shit. Do we die every time we go in a transporter?
And here's the history of all this fucked up shit that's happened in the transporter and the holodeck. We had a holodeck character come out of the holodeck and start causing trouble. We had to let him go.
Do you remember that time Barkley saw worm monsters? Horrifying worm monsters in the transporter buffer?
Barkley.
Oh, wait. The TNG didn't let Moriarty go. He thought they let him go.
They put him in a hologram
they
trick.
They totally tricked
him. It was a classic hologram
classic,
trick.
Classic, yeah. Hologram in a hologram. Are we really in... Are
and
we
he was pulling that on
we're
them.
Still in the simulation.
So next week is the premiere of Star Trek Discovery Season 4. And so it will also be the premiere of the It's Got Star Trek's regular, consistent week-to-week coverage of that particular...
Star Trek Season 4?
Don't search Vore on Gore on Google. Vore and Gore.
Vore and Gore. Don't
Vore and Google. Don't search Vore on Google.
They've got crazy new uniforms, it looks like.
You can search Vore on Reddit, though. Yeah. Go ahead and do that.
Why is that okay?
I don't know.
It's
moderated to some degree.
That's true.
Yeah. So, yeah, they got some crazy new uniforms. We don't know much at all about what's going to go on in Discovery
season four.
We'll
be damned.
this watch.
give me the watch.
give me the watch. Pulp Fiction, 1994. We're excited to watch the season premiere of Discovery. So tune in next Saturday to hear
season premiere.
Our thoughts, our discussion, and possibly some more philosophical in-depth
maybe we'll actually talk about Star Trek.
Maybe
we'll talk a little bit about Star Trek
too.
But until then, we hope you've had an entertaining time.
Stupid fucking pickles.
Yeah. we'll, to the max.
We'll talk to you next week.
Wait, maybe I'm tired of being a hero. Maybe I've thought over what you've said and decided that you're absolutely right.
About what?
Everything. The decadence of the world, the need for order. The more I think about it, the more I realize that your way may be the only way.